Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Vaccination rates in Ohio and across the U.S. continue to drop. Policy decisions at the federal and state level are unraveling decades of work to immunize the young and old alike. Case in point, measles. The number of people contracting measles around the country keeps rising. Doctors say conflicting guidance on measles, COVID, and other vaccines is not helping. New federal guidance on the COVID vaccine led doctors from one group to sue last week. Lauren Gardner is a reporter for Politico with a focus on the FDA and pharmaceutical policy. Welcome back to All Sides, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So we wanted to catch up on some health-related policy matters coming out of the Trump administration and also focus on the latest vaccine news. Health groups led by the American Academy of Pediatrics are suing Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. over COVID guidance related to children and pregnant women. Can you tell us what led to this lawsuit by the American Academy of Pediatrics?
Yeah, so the AAP and several other health groups are pinning their lawsuit on Secretary Kennedy's May 19th secretarial directive. So there was, before he made his announcement on social media about pulling the COVID vaccines from the childhood schedule and from the adult schedule for pregnant people, there was an internal document at HHS documenting that he signed off on this decision. Mm-hmm. That wasn't made public the day he did it, but he made his announcement shortly thereafter. So these groups are saying that the document, the memo that he signed, ran afoul of typical federal procedures for when the head of an agency wants to make a policy decision. So they're essentially saying this should have been subject to public notice, public comment before it was finalized, and that as a result, this is illegal.
And basically what he was saying is that he was leading guidance that said healthy children and pregnant people do not need the COVID booster. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that was the pronouncement he made. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that there's this web of panels and committees and agencies within the health department itself that help set these recommendations that then become policy across the country. And it completely ignored many decades of precedent of how this stuff gets set. Because typically what happens is scientists, both within and outside the federal government, those who independently advise them, you know, look over the data that is collected over time on how vaccines are working, their safety, their effectiveness, and then make decisions about whether, when, and how they should be recommended to the broader public. And the group that advises the CDC on vaccines, this independent advisory group on vaccines, they were expected to meet in June and change the recommendations for COVID vaccines for children. What was expected was that they would continue to recommend an initial dose for young children, but would change the recommendation for older kids to say, you know, it's between your provider and the parent to decide whether kids should get a booster dose, an additional dose every year, just depending on a child's individual situation. But instead, Kennedy made the decision on his own and completely circumvented this group.
Now, absent from the list of plaintiffs in this lawsuit is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, which has advocated for safety and the effectiveness of COVID vaccines in pregnant people. But what is their position on the lawsuit?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had the same question the day of. I reached out to them and they said that they support the effort and that they anticipate filing an amicus brief, which is a legal speak for a friend of the court, essentially a statement affirming that they agree with the position of the plaintiffs here and think that they have a case. So that's how they anticipate making their opinion kind of more formalized in this case. But just because they didn't sign on to the suit, they said, doesn't mean that they don't support the overall push.
Okay, so they're sending a letter saying, good job, we support you, but not actually suing. All right, so the American Academy of Pediatrics president, Susan Cressley, talked with reporters last week, and she mentioned the childhood immunization schedule. What effect has conflicting guidance had on the nation's pediatricians? Because it feels like if you're getting different information from the top, from the president's administration, and then you go and talk to your pediatrician, there's conflicting guidance there.
Absolutely. We've seen a trend over the last several years that was exacerbated by COVID, because just generally the pandemic, people weren't keeping up with well child and just annual physical visits to their doctors. We've seen a trend in vaccination coverage among kindergartners. That's kind of the key metric because of school requirements. It's dropped over the last several years. Right now, the CDC says that as of the 2023 to 2024 school year, immunization coverage has decreased to just under 93%. And that means about 280,000 kindergartners across the country were not up to date on their vaccines. So for a lot of the major diseases that are covered by the vaccines in the schedule, particularly measles, mumps, rubella, the MMR vaccine, mm-hmm. Herd immunity, that level at which the vast majority of the population is considered really well protected from disease, that's set at about 95%. And that's because measles is just incredibly contagious. Public health officials call it the canary in the coal mine. Once you see measles cases tick up, that means there could be a run of other contagious diseases that can be dangerous in childhood start to ratchet up. The fact that that's come down below that threshold level indicates that we could be in for more measles outbreaks starting and then spreading throughout the United States. And we're clearly seeing that right now.
Now, also back to COVID-19 for a minute, the FDA last week approved Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine for children under 12 who are high risk for the disease. The wording here matches up with recent changes on who should get the disease. So I guess, but who determines who is high risk?
That is a great question. So really, it comes down to the patient and their provider. The guidance that FDA put forward, I think it was about a week before Kennedy actually took the step of removing the recommendation from the childhood vaccine schedule. FDA's guidance was that, if you have at least one underlying condition, you should be eligible to get a vaccine dose if you want it. Underlying conditions on the CDC website with respect to COVID-19, they really run the gamut from things you would expect, like asthma, diabetes, to mental health conditions. Immunocompromise is another one that's expected. So there are a lot of things out there that one could argue to their provider make them eligible for a vaccine. What's interesting here, and what's different from the recent past, is that FDA doesn't typically put in their labels for vaccines and medical products this kind of guidance. This is typically a decision that's made by the CDC. Mm-hmm. The CDC is the agency that's supposed to say, hey, this is who we think should be prioritized for getting this vaccine. We think it should be older people, people with underlying conditions, and then, maybe children under a certain age, something like that. FDA is typically of the authority to say, okay, we're approving this this medical product for this age group. There's been this change here where FDA is kind of stepping more into CDC's historical lane and trying to more directly guide who is accessing these things, which is, it's just very different from what's happened before. But it really all comes down to personal choice. And I think what we're going to see is that people may want to get these vaccines, but it's also going to come down to whether their insurance covers it, which mm-hmm. is another issue kind of wrapped up in all of this that not everyone realizes is part of the equation.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about vaccine guidance with Lauren Gardner, a reporter for Politico with a focus on the FDA and pharmaceutical policy. So let's lean into what you just said right there. So if it's not recommended for a COVID vaccine for healthy children, but I decide that I want my healthy child to get the COVID vaccine, either A, to prevent them from getting it really badly, or maybe because there's grandparents in our life that we want to protect, or maybe, you know, you have other people in your life who it would be really bad if they got COVID. So you want to, you know, there's lots of reasons. Anyway, so if I go and I want to get the COVID vaccine, are you saying that my insurance might not cover it?
This is an open question. So as of right now, insurance companies haven't indicated that they're going to be making any changes to their coverage of COVID vaccines, but that could change. And this is because the Affordable Care Act required that most health insurance plans, most private health insurance plans, have to cover vaccines with no cost sharing. And the vaccines that they have to cover are those that are recommended by the ACIP. That's the committee I was talking about that advises the CDC, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. If they recommend a vaccine for routine use, that's supposed to be essentially free to the person who wants to get it for their child. Now, the COVID vaccines for children aren't completely unrecommended, for lack of a better word, but they've been kind of downgraded to what's called shared clinical decision making. So like I was saying earlier, it's up to, you know, a conversation between the patient and or, you know, their parent and the healthcare provider about whether they want to go ahead and vaccinate. So it's kind of seen as like not as strong of a recommendation, of a push by the federal government that, hey, everyone should be getting this, but instead seen more as a, like, you know, maybe depending on your situation, you might want to consider getting this vaccine, and, you know, you talk to your doctor about it. Because of the way the law is written, there's some questions about whether it would actually, if the vaccines are downgraded to this other level that I talked about, which they have been as of now, whether insurance companies would be required to cover it with no cost sharing. So like I said, it doesn't seem like any changes are coming, at least as of yet, but could that change in the future? Absolutely.
I guess I don't know if vaccines are expensive. Like, if I don't go through insurance and I just want to rogue get vaccines, can I afford it? I don't know how much it costs.
Yeah, and that's a great question. I believe it was referenced in the American Academy of Pediatrics lawsuit, and I don't have it right in front of me, but I remember from talking to doctors within the last week or two about these sorts of issues. I mean, vaccines can cost anywhere from, let's say, you know, north of $50, $75 to a couple hundred dollars, especially if it's a newer product, if it's a newer vaccine, you know, like any new drug, they tend to be more expensive. So, you know, when you think of how many vaccines kids have to get at different age groups, that can really add up. And, you know, if you're a family on a fixed income, that might not be something that you can readily afford.
Now, we had you on the show recently to talk about the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which you mentioned.
Yes.
Secretary Kennedy fired all 17 members, which included Columbus Public Health Director Dr. Mashika Roberts, who didn't get a chance to start her July term, and he replaced it with an 8-person panel. When we had you on, they were in the midst of their meetings. So did any more recommendations come out of those meetings toward the last 2 days of the meetings? Anything about the flu vaccine? And there was something about RSV, right?
Yes. RSV, they did end up recommending the second. It's technically a monoclonal antibody, which is different from a vaccine, but it's an injectable. It generates passive immunity to the germ you're talking about, which in this case is RSV. They did end up recommending that product. So that creates a situation where there already was one on the market. So now there are two that are available, and there can be a little bit more competition between insurance companies over, you know, how they're covered and how much they end up costing. On the other side, on flu, yes, there was a big development in that they did vote to recommend an updated formula for flu for the coming winter season. But they also took a vote to essentially not recommend that anyone of any age group get a flu vaccine that contains thimerosal, which is a preservative. It's a organic mercury-containing compound that metabolizes completely differently from mercury. Like when you think of it in the context of, you know, cutting down on how much fish you eat because mm-hmm. you're concerned about mercury content. It metabolizes a different way. It doesn't stay in your body the way that that type of mercury does. But anti-vaccine activists have seized on this ingredient as something that might cause chronic health conditions. Some maintain that it can cause autism, even though there have been ample studies completely disproving that link. But so this committee took that vote. And while the vast majority of flu vaccine that's available in the United States doesn't contain thimerosal, and that's because there was a shift about 25 years ago towards making single dose vials of flu mm-hmm. vaccine as opposed to multi-dose, where sometimes you might see at a doctor's office, you know, they go into the vial, pull up a little bit, you know, measure it to make sure it's right. And then there's still a little bit left in the vial for the next person. Mm-hmm. Most flu vaccines are single dose vials. In the case of multi-dose vials, that's why thimerosal has been included in those flu vaccine products, because like I said, a preservative. So it prevents microbial growth. So when you stab something multiple times, it can introduce all kinds of germs, right? So you want to prevent that from happening. While most providers don't use those vials, public health experts say that those products are most likely given to or purchased by state or local health departments that are doing like mass vaccination drives. Mm-hmm. So you might see those in your community periodically during the very beginning of flu season. So we haven't gotten good intel yet on who exactly would be most affected by this. But it's safe to say that there's a lot of concern that the fact that they took this vote indicates that there was a safety concern there to begin with, that that scientists say just isn't the case.
But bottom line is that these multi-dose vials are not allowed anymore. Is that
I would expect that they would not be found in the United States this coming season. Yes.
Okay. I think we'll probably have you back again for more updates, because I think this is going to keep continuing. But we've been talking with Lauren Gardner, a reporter for Politico, who focuses on the FDA and pharmaceutical policy. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to talk with a pediatrician about childhood immunizations. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
If you missed the latest story on the Moth Radio Hour or the laughs from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you can listen to them on your schedule through the WOSU Public Media mobile app.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, Ohio's health director, earlier this year sounded the alarm about fewer people getting vaccinated.
This decline is alarming, especially given now that we've seen multiple serious outbreaks in the country in recent years.
His comments came in the midst of a measles outbreak, but before the current number of cases, which is 1,200 cases nationwide, children and teens make up most of the cases. Add to that recent federal directives that healthy children and pregnant women no longer need the COVID vaccine. Joining us now is pediatrician Dr. Chris Peltier. He is the immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Peltier.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
And the school year will be here before we know it. And summer is when many parents take care of those well check visits, and which includes getting their children immunizations, especially for children who are starting kindergarten. Why do you think the vaccination rate has been declining around the country and in Ohio?
So I think it's probably multifactorial, and there's not always just one answer. I think probably one of the biggest issues is that really over the last 5 years, really since the COVID pandemic, I think we've been seeing a big uptick in misinformation on vaccines, on pediatric science. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, there's lots of sort of chaos, for lack of a better term, coming from the administration as far as, you know, vaccine recommendations, with the Secretary of HHS essentially firing all of the previous advisors to the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices and replacing them with many people who have spent a career sort of being anti-vax. So I think there is a lot of misinformation. I think parents are confused and not sure what to do. And then, you know, I think there's also not so much right now, but a fear of, as we're battling cuts with Medicaid, and access to care, I think, is also going to contribute to fewer kids having access to vaccines. You know, you had mentioned Dr. Vanderhoff's comments. So this past school year, the immunization rates for kindergartners who met all of the requirements was about 85.4% for the 24-25 school year. That's down from 86.2% the prior year. And that's a big drop. If you go back just pre-pandemic, 2019, that number was 89.9%. So again, kind of fitting in that timeline of during the COVID pandemic. And we're well below, Ohio is well below that national average for kindergarten readiness in terms of vaccinations, which sits at 92%.
Now, in your practice, you work at the Pediatric Associates of Mount Carmel in Cincinnati. Do you have parents asking you about vaccines and whether they should be vaccinating their kids?
We do. And when we think about, or we see families with vaccine hesitancy, that's probably the majority of what we're seeing. You know, vaccine hesitancy versus what I distinguish from outright vaccine refusal. Most of the families, you know, just they have questions, right? Look, they want to make sure that what they're doing for their kids is safe. And, you know, obviously as pediatricians, that's our main objective as well, right? We want to keep kids healthy and safe. So most of the time, when I have a family in my office that has questions about vaccines, it's, you know, is it really safe to give all of these vaccines at once? Or is this vaccine really necessary? And really, you know, it's just sitting down with the families, just listening to their concerns, and then really talking with them often is really what parents need. Now, there are definitely, you know, the few that families are, there is no way my child's going to get any vaccines. You know, and I think that truly is, even though I think that group often makes the most noise in the media and on social media, I think it's really more the parents that just have some questions and just need some reassurance and some information to help make their decisions.
That idea of so many all at once, because there's certain stages in a child's life whenever they need more than one shot at a time, just because of the vaccine schedule, that comes up often. Do you ever recommend or allow parents who are worried to spread it out more and go off the schedule a little bit?
Yeah. So when I get that question, you know, I talk with parents and I say, really, these are the way the vaccines were studied. When the vaccines were going through their licensure, their study phase that the FDA requires, they were given with multiple vaccines at one time. We know that's safe. Babies' immune systems can handle that. Babies' immune systems are inundated daily with various bacteria and viruses, much more so than what they see from vaccines. So I always tell parents that really it's safe and babies' immune systems can handle this. Now, if a family is really adamant my ultimate goal is to have a child get vaccinated. So I do not routinely recommend a spaced out or alternative vaccine schedule. However, if after having conversations with a family and it's the family, that's the only way their child's going to get vaccinated, then I will do that, because ultimately the goal is to protect that child.
You have to make them promise to come back, though, because once they leave the office, what if they don't come back?
Well, so, you know, again, it's just having those conversations, you know, following up, you know, keeping those conversations open.
Now, the word vaccination and the word immunization are used interchangeably in all these conversations. From a medical perspective, are those two words the same?
So, you know, really, vaccination includes two types of immunization. So there is what we call passive immunization, and there's active immunization. Passive immunization is when we introduce into the body an antibody that will protect against a certain disease state. So the most common right now is with the new RSV immunization that we began giving babies 2 years ago to protect them against respiratory syncytial virus. In that case, babies get a one-time dose of the antibody that protects them against the virus if they encounter it. The majority of other childhood immunizations or vaccines are what we call active immunization. So within that vial, that dose that a baby or a child receives is either a piece of a protein from a virus or a bacteria, or in some cases, a live virus that has been weakened so that it does not cause actual disease, so that when the baby's immune system encounters either that protein or that weakened live virus, it produces antibodies on its own to protect them against when they encounter a disease. And that's really more effective. The passive immunization is only going to last for a certain amount of time. And actually, babies get some passive immunity from moms through the placenta for those first few months of life. So they're actually protected via passive immunization. We know that active immunization, sort of priming the immune system with that primary series of vaccines in the first 2 years of life, and then doing the booster doses between age 4 and 6, is really the best way to long-term protect kids against disease. You know, going back to, you played that clip from Dr. Vanderhoff about measles. We know that one dose of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine will protect about 95% of the population against getting measles. When they get that second booster dose between age 4 and 6, that goes up to 98, almost 99%. So again, even though, yes, we're seeing measles, if you're vaccinated, you are protected.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about vaccination rates among children with pediatrician Dr. Chris Peltier, immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So let's talk about those school vaccines that you just mentioned. Schools typically require certain vaccinations to start kindergarten. One of them is measles, mumps, rubella, the MMR. I think polio. Is this still the case? Are there certain vaccines that are required for kindergarten?
It is, you know, typically the routine, what we consider the routine vaccination. So diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, haemophilus, pneumococcal disease, which is just strep bacteria, measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis A, hepatitis B.
And so if a family does not vaccinate, are they able to send their kid to a public school?
So this is where Ohio has, it's only one of 12 states that has what is called both a personal and a religious exemption. And essentially what that means is any family can, for, you know, whatever, they basically can say, I don't believe in vaccines, and that will allow them to sort of get out of that requirement, which is one of the big things. As we see more and more kids that are not getting vaccinated, we run the risk of seeing diseases that we have never seen in my lifetime. I've been a practicing pediatrician for 26 years. You know, in 2000, measles was essentially eliminated from the United States. And just this past week, you know, the New York Times released an article that the United States has now had more cases of measles since 2000, since it was eradicated. So that's the risk we run.
I wanted to ask you about the COVID guidance. Health groups led by the American Academy of Pediatrics recently sued the Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. over new COVID guidance for children and pregnant women. He said that healthy kids and pregnant people no longer need to get the COVID vaccine. What is your take on that directive? I mean, you're a pediatrician, so we can lean in on the healthy kids. Should healthy kids be getting a COVID booster?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I want to preface my comments as I'm not cannot speak on behalf of the national AAP. So this is just my opinion as a practicing pediatrician. I think the biggest issue that I think myself and many of my colleagues have with the way that was worded is that regardless of your personal belief about the COVID vaccine, by the secretary coming out with that statement, and first off, you know, number one, it was the way in which that decision was arrived, right? He went outside of the usual channels, which was involving the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices, essentially released a video on social media saying this is what's going to happen, which really has not been done for that's, you know, for 40 years, that is not the system where you rely on experts in pediatrics, infectious disease, vaccine experts to give recommendations. And ACIP in the past has not always recommended every vaccine. There have been vaccines that ACIP has said there is not evidence to support this. Mm-hmm. So number one, that was one of the issues. The other issue is that really, again, whether you want your child or not to get this vaccine, whether you believe in it, by saying that it should not be recommended for healthy children, what that means is that is sort of an out for insurance companies to pay for that vaccine. Mm-hmm. You know, insurance companies, as well as the Vaccine for Children's Fund, which is a federally funded, state-run program that allows for children on Medicaid, as well as those without any insurance, to receive vaccines free of charge. That runs the risk of those vaccines not being available and either having to pay out of pocket, or if you are on Medicaid or self-pay, you don't have access to those vaccines at all. So that, I think, is as a pediatrician, is my biggest issue. When it comes to the COVID vaccine, sort of I sit down with parents, we talk about the pros and cons. Is your child at risk? Do you live with anybody that's immunocompromised? And we really sort of have a shared decision-making conversation, which is very similar to, in Ohio, there is a required meningitis vaccine for high school students. There is a second meningitis vaccine that protects against meningitis B that we recommend for a subset of the population. And the way that the sort of the CDC recommends that is that it's recommended that it should be considered and discussed with the patient. And by doing that, it doesn't require it, but it allows us to have that conversation, and it really requires insurance companies and the Vaccine for Children's program to cover that vaccine, which really, I think, ultimately is what we were sort of hoping. You know, again, I think we're learning much about the COVID vaccine, and, you know, I'm similar to flu, not making it required. I don't think it will ever be required, but I do think families should have the option if they want to protect their kids, or they have a loved one that might be at severe risk if they get COVID, to having their insurance companies being able to cover that.
Hmm. Okay. So if, you know, if a parent comes to you and wants the COVID vaccine for their healthy kid, you will give it to them. You just will warn them that maybe their insurance might not cover it. They should check.
Exactly. And right now, I mean, it's all sort of still in flux, because soon after he said that, the CDC kind of did backtrack a little bit. We're really waiting to see where that sort mm-hmm. of ends up falling out, you know, and especially for pregnant moms. We know there's lots of data that moms who get COVID during pregnancy can have significant health mm-hmm. risks for both themselves as well as their baby. But exactly. So right now it's still covered, but we run the risk of it not being covered in the future.
Yeah. And a couple of times you have talked about vaccine requirements for kindergarten, the meningitis one you just mentioned for high school. But if Ohio is one of 12 states that allows personal and religious exemptions, then it's not really a requirement, right?
Exactly. And, okay. and that's the issue. And, you know, there was at least one point, and I'll be honest, I'm not sure if that still exists, where families would have to come to their pediatrician, at least have them sign a form that they had that conversation. Mm-hmm. I have not had any families bring me that form in a while, and I'm not sure if that's still a requirement in the state of Ohio or not. I will say that.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can just sign anything and say it's your personal belief or religious belief. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. Again, we're only one of 12 states that has that.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about one other vaccine, the cancer prevention shots for preteens, the HPV vaccine.
Yep.
I've heard talk about that. It's just there's a lot of news happening with the Health and Human Services Secretary Kennedy. Is that vaccine still recommended?
It is. They have not ruled on that. And that's a good thing. You know, HPV is hemopapillomavirus mm-hmm. causes several diseases in young adults. It can cause genital warts. More importantly, it's the leading cause of cancer, cervical cancer, penile cancer, throat cancer. And we know actually, since the beginning of recommending and administering HPV, we know that rates of cervical cancer in women have drastically dropped. And now actually throat cancer is now sort of the leading cancer that's caused by HPV. So yes, it's still available. It is not a required vaccine for teenagers in Ohio, but it's one of those things that, again, would strongly recommend. It is the only vaccine proven to prevent cancer.
That's what I was just going to say. I mean, I think that's the dream whenever people talk about like getting rid of cancer, have vaccine for cancer. We found one, right? For one of them at least.
Exactly. One of the issues when HPV first came out, I think a lot of the discussion was focused around HPV as a sexually transmitted disease. And I think that made it sometimes hard to have conversations when you're recommending it for 9-year-olds, right? To have that conversation with a parent about the sexual activity of their then 9-year-old. And so really, I really focus, and I think it's much more effective, and I think it's much more meaningful when we talk about it as a cancer prevention vaccine.
We've been talking with pediatrician Dr. Chris Peltier, immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thank you so much for your time today.
Amy, thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Coming up, an infectious disease expert weighs in. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to wosu.org/protect.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Vaccination rates in Ohio and across the U.S. continue to drop. Policy decisions at the federal and state level are unraveling decades of work to immunize the young and old alike. Case in point, measles. The number of people contracting it across the country keeps rising. From measles to COVID, doctors say conflicting guidance from the top is not helping. A leading medical group just sued the Trump administration over new COVID protocols. Joining us now is Dr. John Schwartzberg, Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases and Vaccinology at UC Berkeley. Welcome back to All Sides, Dr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you.
So first, a general question here. The trickle-down effect with fewer people getting vaccinated or fewer kindergartners showing up at kindergarten without a full roster of shots, how long does that take to have broad public health ramifications?
Well, the public health ramifications will take a while, several years usually, but the individual ramifications can be fairly soon after not being vaccinated. We've seen that, for example, in this measles outbreak where very young children are getting measles. And we know that measles is a much more dangerous disease in the very, very young. So you can have immediate effects on individuals, but from a public health standpoint, the effects sort of wind up over year after year after year, and it becomes cumulative. And we see that in this measles outbreak as well, because we're seeing cases of people in their 20s and 30s and even 40s who didn't get vaccinated. Yeah. So the effects are short-term and the effects are long-term.
I wanted to talk with you about recent changes that occurred with the federal government's recommendations when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccine. It was recommended from Health and Human Services Secretary Kennedy that healthy children do not need the shot. Pregnant women do not need the shot either. So healthy children and pregnancy, no COVID boosters. What are your thoughts on rolling back the COVID vaccine for these groups?
I think that was a terrible decision made by someone without transparency, without medical knowledge, and with a strong bias against vaccines. That's RFK Jr. I think it was absolutely a horrific decision. If you look at very young children who get COVID, their morbidity and mortality, the bad effects from COVID, are just about as great as older people over 65. And we've seen that with quite a few deaths from COVID in the very, very young. You can't protect children under the age of about 6 months with the vaccine because their immune system won't respond to the vaccine very well. The only way these infants can be protected is by getting antibodies from mom during pregnancy. And those antibodies last a few months and bridge that gap between being born and having an immune system that can respond to the vaccine. What this all means is that it's putting these very young infants at increased risk unnecessarily. It also has implications for mom. We know that one of the risk factors for a bad outcome if you get COVID is pregnancy. So pregnancy listed even by an FDA, two people at the FDA who are clearly have a bent against vaccines, even they listed pregnancy as a risk factor. So this decision by RFK Jr. is putting infants at risk, is putting other children at risk, and is putting pregnant moms at risk. Terrible decision.
I was watching a TV story out of a Cincinnati TV station when these new directives came out related to the COVID vaccines for children, and it invited viewers to comment, and there were hundreds and hundreds of replies within like an hour of the story airing that agreed with Kennedy's decision. Now, granted, you know, comments on a TV story are not scientific by any means, but what do you make of that kind of response of hundreds of comments agreeing with Kennedy? Is it COVID fatigue, vaccine fatigue?
Well, I think in the case of the example you're giving, it exemplifies how important a spokesperson from the government is in terms of shaping the opinions of the American populace. And we have in Kennedy someone who has committed decades of his life to being against vaccines. And now he has a platform where he can promulgate his disinformation and misinformation that he's giving to the public. And that creates a lot of confusion in the public. And we know that confusion leads to people not wanting to get vaccinated.
Would you recommend someone who has healthy children, would you recommend them getting the COVID booster in the fall? Even if their insurance isn't covering it, I talked before with another reporter who was saying it might, you know, vaccines cost sometimes $50, $100. You never know. You don't really know. And we're not really sure whether insurance companies are going to cover it if it's not recommended. But would you recommend anyone who can should get the COVID vaccine?
Yes, I would. Particularly those people at high risk. But the vaccine has demonstrated in millions and millions of people a very good track record of safety. And we know that although COVID is not as severe a disease as it was today, as it was 3 years, 4 years, and 5 years ago, it's still taking around 200 Americans a day their lives at a time when COVID levels are low. So I would ask people to give serious consideration, talk to their physicians about the pros and cons, and seriously consider, even if they're in very good health, to get vaccinated. I'd also suggest that parents should look at the American Association of Pediatrics and look at their recommendations, because they're going to give good, sound, scientific recommendations for the benefit of, excuse me, of children and the families.
Well, they're suing right now, the Trump administration, because of the COVID guidance, saying that they didn't do their due diligence in this recommendation. So do you think, because right now we're waiting to see if insurance companies will still pay for the COVID vaccine. Do you think that while this lawsuit is pending, maybe they will? Or what, I guess, talk about your worry about insurance companies paying for it or not.
Sure. The insurance companies by law have to follow the recommendations from the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices and then the CDC. So if the CDC, through the Advisory Committee, ACIP, is not recommending, they can suggest, but if they're not recommending a vaccine, insurance companies do not have to pay for it. What's really interesting is that some of the very large insurance companies, both nationally and here where I am in California, have already said that they're going to pay for the COVID vaccine. Now, why would they do that? It could be out of benevolence, but these are businesses that have to make a profit. Mm-hmm. And so they look at the numbers, and they're pretty well aware of the fact that vaccines are very cheap and they work very well, and they're going to prevent a lot of people from going to the emergency room, being hospitalized, being in the ICU, and tragically dying. And a few cases of people in the ICU would cover an awful lot of people getting vaccinated.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about COVID vaccines and other infectious diseases with Dr. John Schwartzberg with UC Berkeley. What else? What do you want our listeners to know about COVID today? Obviously, as you were talking, you're saying it hasn't gone away, even though it seems like it's something that is more akin to the flu than it used to be.
Yeah, I think you made two very good points. And that is, it hasn't gone away, and that it is more similar today to influenza than it was just 2 or 3 years ago. The numbers of people, as I mentioned a few moments ago, dying from COVID is way down from where it was. But we're still losing 200, 220, 250 Americans a week to this virus. And we're at a very low level of disease. No one can predict what COVID's going to do in the next month, much less the next 6 months or year. The one thing we can confidently say is it's not going to go away, and that we have something that can protect us from getting real sick from COVID. That's the vaccine. And also the vaccine can help protect us against that really terrible problem that doesn't get enough attention called long COVID. So again, COVID is not the disease it was 5 years ago. I can still picture in my mind New York City with the hospital ship out in front and people in morgues, makeshift morgues, and so on. It's not that disease anymore. And it's not that disease because practically everybody has some degree of immunity, either from vaccination or previous infection or infections with COVID.
In your experience, has the federal government ever changed any other vaccine recommendations like this change that was made with the COVID-19 recommendations?
Yes. The CDC, through its advisory committee, has made changes, and sometimes the head of the CDC even has rejected the suggestions by the advisory committee. So it doesn't happen often, because previously all of the material presented was very carefully vetted by strong scientists, very experienced in vaccinology and public health and medicine. So the decisions were made by people looking at data, not by opinion. Today, the ACIP is stacked with people who have an opinion, a bias against vaccines, and we have no director of the CDC yet. So we have Kennedy, a known anti-vaxxer, making decisions not based upon science, but based upon his whims.
So can you give me an example of something that they've changed a recommendation on? Do you know?
Well, very recently, a new vaccine against a disease with a funny name called chikungunya, which is a vector-borne disease, a disease spread by mosquitoes, that's now getting into the Caribbean and approaching the United States. There was a vaccine approved for this, and continued monitoring of it suggested there may be some complications from it in older people, and so the vaccine was was put on hold for people 65 and over. That's the most recent, but there's quite a few other examples going back in history.
Before we end, we were talking in the previous segment with a pediatrician from here in Ohio, and he was saying that Ohio is one of 12 states that allow personal and religious exemptions against vaccination. So despite the fact that we do have requirements, there's a certain vaccines you need to have to be able to go to kindergarten, to be able to go to high school. The requirement's not a requirement if you have personal and religious exemptions. What do you think the implications are for that if 12 states don't actually have real requirements?
Look at Texas, which is one of those states. And you can see what's happening with measles in Texas right now. California, the state that I'm in, has the largest population in the country, yet we've only had a handful of cases of measles. The major reason for that is that exemptions, personal belief exemptions, religious exemptions, are generally not accepted.
Do you feel that that can be changed? Is that something that can be changed, maybe not during this administration, but in the future? Or is it really a states' rights situation?
Oh, I think that this definitely can be changed. Whether it's a state's rights or a federal issue is beyond my bandwidth to address, but certainly it can be changed because we've seen other states successfully having these policies and protecting their populations. So yes, the pendulum can definitely swing in the other direction.
We've been talking with Dr. John Schwartzberg, a professor emeritus of infectious diseases and vaccinology at UC Berkeley. Thank you for your time today, Dr. Schwartzberg.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. I want to say thank you to senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our student producers Chris Corcoran, David Stein, Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and our student producer from Denison University, Kiara Burson. Video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen at our website. That's wosu.org/allsides. You can subscribe to our podcast or listen to any show for free using our mobile app. Thanks for joining us today on 89.7 NPR News.